thank you all for coming. We are very pleased and privileged to have the Prabhus with us today. It's very, don't see that very often, so thank you for coming. You're most welcome.
Thank you for inviting us.
You're always invited. Today is 2nd of October, 2012. We are privileged to have my godbrother Dineshwara here with us today, and Dineshwara he's a scholarly type of guy, and he has written this book, Lessons in Spiritual Economics from the Bhagavad Gita, Part 1. Is there two parts here? Three.
Eventually.
How many do we have here today?
Just one.
One here today. Understanding and Solving the Economic Problem. Dineshwara Das. I assume the books are available for purchase.
Sure.
Very good. So he's going to speak on this subject matter, for which I'm very eager to listen. I just got back from America, where I visited Las Vegas. Not for the reasons you think. I visited San Diego and Silicon Valley and Boulder, Colorado. And it was for me a very pivotal time, pivotal experience. I was invited to speak in front of 1,700 people in Vegas. It was a lot of people, a lot of energy. And they belonged to a health supplements company. Now, mostly when they have these conventions, these big companies and corporations that have a product or a service to sell, it's kind of a big pep rally where they're enthusing the troops. Get out there and sell more product. That's kind of how these things typically work. Well, they definitely did some of that. But I was the keynote speaker. I was the last person to speak. And everybody had anywhere from 5 minutes to 15 minutes to speak. And when he invited me to be the keynote speaker, he says, "You got 35 minutes. I said, "What, 35 minutes? I said, "I'm just getting warmed up in 35 minutes. So he gave me an hour and 15 minutes. Well, which I used. And all I spoke about was essentially Dharma and spiritual subjects unheard of in such a place like this. But I'm telling you, they were on the wavelength. It was almost a transcendental experience for me. So we did a PowerPoint presentation. They asked me to put it together, and they'd organize it, put it up, big, huge screens, you know, where your face is 20 feet high. Lots of video cameras everywhere, translated into several languages. Everybody had a headpiece. They were from all different countries. And so when we were organizing the PowerPoint presentation, the guy had put in a Sanskrit slide. It was Sanskrit, but it wasn't so nicely done. I could barely read it myself. So I sent him one that I had. And I sent it to him, and I was sitting there and I was reading it, because I never looked at it carefully before. And it's the opening verses of the Bhagavad Gita. That's what it was. So that's what they put up on the screen. Before I walked out, they had the Bhagavad Gita up on the screen in Sanskrit. So as I walked out, I said, "This is Kurukshetra. That's what this is." And
for you.
For me. This is my Kurukshetra. And anyway, it went went great. So Krishna really blessed me. Prabhupada blessed me a lot on that particular occasion. Okay, so less about me, more about Dineshwar Prabhu.
My book, I speak about economics from the spiritual perspective. This particular book is actually an explanation of material economics using the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita. And on that basis, I can tell you very confidently that whatever they're doing on the world scene, they're not going to be able to solve the economic problem for everyone. They solve it for some, and there's a lot of people, many people in the world, who'd have no economic problem at all. But of course, there's many people that do. So the question becomes, who do we want to solve the economic problem for? Me and my friends, a few other people too, enough to keep the ball rolling, or everybody? Should we leave some people out? And if so, who? And why? What's the basis for understanding who is a fit candidate to enjoy the pleasures of life and who are those who are not worthy of being considered? It's quite possible, actually, even with the economic arrangement that we use today, to solve the economic problem for everyone. But the fact is that they don't want to do that. And so when we start talking about economics in these terms, then we get into some of the darker aspects of life in this world. Who's controlling these things and why? What's their purpose and what are they planning and so on like that? In any case, we can talk about spiritual economics from many different perspectives, but I thought tonight that I'd speak to you from the perspective of karma. And this is not an approach that I usually take, but I thought, given, let's say, how I know Duryodhana and Duryodhana Guru, and even before you were teaching, right? You've been a teacher a long time, isn't? Yeah. So, because you must all be students of his, that I thought maybe this perspective of speaking from karma would be interesting for you. How many of you have seen the movie The Secret? Okay, almost everybody. This movie is gives a basic explanation of karma. In this movie, for those of you who haven't seen it, they bring many different speakers who are telling that we can have everything, anything that we want. Anything. Anything. And all you have to do is just think about it. And it's true. It works like that. Every thought is an act. And that act sets into motion the arrangements of the material world to deliver to you the result of what you desired. They left some important things out of this movie. The main thing is that if you don't have the karmic, let's say, bank balance in this lifetime to get your desire, you're going to have to come back again. Or maybe again and again and again, or maybe again and again and again and again and again, ad infinitum. That's generally how it goes. An important detail, right? Well, maybe I didn't want it that bad. This is economics in one sense. Economics means basically, how does the world work? Huh? Now, in the modern sense, we've given a very limited understanding of this word, of meaning dollars and cents and banking and so on like that. But the root word of economics comes from Greek economos. That word translated to English is household. And basically means, how do we get the fundamentals that we need to live? Food, shelter, and clothing. Generally, people, let's say, in previous ages, prior to the advent of money, which is a relatively recent invention, about 2,500 years old, prior to that time, people still had an economic problem, and they solved it in very different ways. In the book, this book, I explain how they solved the economic problem according to their conscience, or consciousness, let's say. That is, how many of you know about the gunas? No. Okay.
Modes of nature.
Three modes of material nature? Yes? No?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Goons are Irish biscuit for dress.
Okay.
For what?
Draft.
Modes of material nature, Lord Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, is basically the underlying laws by which this world works. For example, Lord Krishna states, Prakriti kriyamana ni gunai karmani sarvasya ahankara vimudhatma kartaham iti manyate, that the soul, bewildered by the influence of material nature, thinks that he's the doer of activities. But actually, all these things are being carried out by nature itself. So, we have a desire, and we think, okay, I want to build a table. And we begin by creating in our mind a design, what I want my table to look like. And then I go about assembling the materials, and then fashion them into the finished product. And it appears, as a result of my activity, that I'm the creator of the table. I thought about it. I brought the materials together. I made it. But Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, no, you're not the doer of activity. Actually, these things are being carried out by nature. And so it is, practically speaking, with everything that's going on in this world. We take birth in a particular place, particular time, according to desire. We have previous desires, and our karma, or let's say our karmic reactions from our previous lives, our previous desires. Right? All those desires that we had in the previous life that were not fulfilled, they are what force us to be born again. So, actually, everyone has a big stock, a huge stock of what are called desire seeds. Like seeds. So many seeds are in the ground. You go out, any of you, I'm sure, have this experience, you pull up all the plants out of the ground, and soon enough, something will be growing there again. Because the seeds are present in the soil. And when there's the opportunity, then they will sprout. So the same way, we have unlimited numbers of desires connected with the things of this world, which we're carrying around with us, and they're waiting for a favorable opportunity to grow. So, we our modern society actually misleads us, teaching us that we can be the cause of the results of our activities. If we work hard, if we do particular things, then we'll get the result of our desire. But you know, it's not true, because there's so many people who they're not successful with that. They have their desire. They're doing whatever they can to fulfill that desire, and still the result doesn't come. Yet there's others, they have very simple desire, and without doing anything, the result comes. So these two things appear to be contradictory. There must be something more that's operating that we don't understand. And of course that is karma, the laws of karma, and the controller of karma. Let's approach this from our own personal perspective. Forget about all the macroeconomics and what's going on the world scene. Let's talk about our own economic life and how that's working. We're all born into this world with, in a particular place, circumstance, according to our previous activities and their previous karma. And this life, there's a destiny that so much will be given to us, and not more than that. And so, of course, people, they're not aware of this. Depending on their culture, they approach things in various different ways. In some cultures, they're trained to be satisfied with the bare minimum of life. If we go back several, or even 1,000 years, or even less, and look at the indigenous cultures around the world, most of those cultures, we can say, are cultures predominantly influenced by sattva, or the mode of goodness. And the way that, the influence of that guna is that people are basically satisfied. They live a natural life. They gather what they need, and not more. And they're happy. We see so many anthropological studies of such cultures. One particular I'm familiar with is the Kalahari Bushmen of Africa. They live in the sub-Sahara area, and they're nomadic people. And they are nomadic people. They go to one from one area to the other, and they find what they need. In situ means locally, whatever they need. So they go to a place, whatever food is there, that's what they eat. When the food stock begins to get low, they move to someplace else. They eat whatever's there. And they keep on going like this. This is how they maintain themselves. As far as clothing, sub-Saharan Africa, what kind of clothes you need? Practically nothing. That's what they wear. And as far as possessions go, since they're nomadic, they don't want any. So, one anthropologist, Marshall Solins, he studied them. He called them the original affluent people, which is a little bit startling from our culture, right? We usually think of affluence as having a lot of money, but affluence means having your needs fulfilled. And so he said they're the original affluent people. All of their needs are fulfilled. He suggested to them one time that why don't you, for example, they go to a place and there's a lot of whatever, honey or something or... And so he suggested to him, well, maybe you want to put some of that aside and keep it for later. And they look at him like, are you crazy? What? For later? For what? In their world, they live in a world of plenty. There's not that you have to keep something for when you don't have it, right? There is no such time as you don't have it. It's always there. And when it runs low here, then you go over there, this other place, and then you go over there. And nature by itself restores the plenty. Nature is very generous. So this is how they live. So this is solving the economic problem in Sattva-gun. Only taking what we need and being satisfied with that. Well, things change when we get into the influence of Rajagun or passion. Under that influence, one is not satisfied with whatever they have. So the predominant, the characteristic of Rajagun is more. Whatever it is, I want more. Never satisfied. Go from sattva being satisfied and having plenty to rajagun not being satisfied, never having enough. So this is characteristic of our modern society. Modern society, we're not satisfied with what we have, we want to get more. Of course, advertisers, they know how this works. They must have also read Bhagavad Gita. Krishna states there, while contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachment for them. Oh, so they put all kinds of advertisements in front of us so that we can contemplate the objects of the senses and develop attachment for them. And it works. It works so well that they have cultural hegemony with television. Wherever television goes, indigenous culture, the indigenous sattvic culture is destroyed. Because then nobody's satisfied. Well, the old people are satisfied, but the young people, they're going to leave that and go to the city. Why? Because in Rajagun, the person becomes enticed, becomes desirous to have contact with the sense objects. I see something and I want to taste it, I want to hear it, I want to, whatever kind of sense stimulation it's giving, that's what I'm after. So I see this, I want it, I see that, I want it. Just like every new gizmo that comes right now, the advertisement. What did I see on the plane today?
iPod?
No, not for the iPod. For the Samsung Galaxy 3. the competitor's product. The next best great thing, isn't it? That's what they call it. You know, there's always going to be the next best great thing, and everybody knows that, right? So it's just a matter of waiting. The next best great thing is going to come along, and gotta have it, right? Not satisfied with the old one anymore. So this is Rajagun, and what this does is keeps people disturbed. We have stuff; everybody's got stuff. You see Annie? What's her name? Annie's Story of Stuff by Annie. Annie who?
I saw
not Annie Lennox. Annie Lennox comes to mind, but that's
no. Out on the internet.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's one, you go on YouTube, there's one very nice little video made, the story of stuff. And she takes everybody through all we have, all this stuff, and where does it come from, and where does it wind up?
Is it a cartoon?
It's written in as a cartoon, but it's a very, very nicely done. Actually, she began this in college. She was studying ecology, and she would go out and study dumps. She would look in the garbage dump and see what's there. This is how she began. And if you want to see a very entertaining but a little bit more vulgar story of stuff, you watch George Carlin's Story of Stuff. You know George Carlin? American comedian who's no longer with us. But he tells a very good story also. In any case, for both of these people, they show the story of stuff is that there's too much stuff. We all have too much stuff, and so we want more. So what's the point? What's the point of the stuff? Are we going to become satisfied with stuff? If that's the case, why weren't we satisfied with the stuff we got last week, or last month, or last year? And then it goes further than that, because as society is progressing, we're becoming more and more degraded by the influence of tamagun, or the mode of ignorance. And the way we get our stuff, the way we get our wealth, is by exploiting others, which is the order of the day. Naomi Klein, she wrote a book called Disaster. What is it called? It was about disaster capitalism. Help me out. Anybody? Naomi Klein?
I've heard of her. I don't remember.
Oh, maybe it'll come to me. Not enough sleep on the plane. Shock Doctrine. Shock Doctrine is about how certain people in the world are profiting by disaster. It's a very horrific book to read, very difficult book to read, actually. But it explains how things are going on. So, anyway, back to karma. How do we get those things? Now, we have our lot in life by which we will get our quota. And our efforts to do more than that, they may be successful in the short run, but in the long run, they won't last. In other words, I can go hold up a bank, or let's take a real-world example. People that win the lotto, many of them, although they become fantastically wealthy, they very quickly lose that money. And they find themselves even in a worse situation than before they won the lotto. So this is karma. They have a particular destiny to have this particular amount of wealth. They win the win the lotto, the wealth comes, but then it's gone again. They have their destiny, their karma. But without understanding this principle of karma, we are destroying the world. Everybody's eager to get more and more and more. And in the process, what we're doing, the way we're doing it, the way we go about it, is to take. We take from the earth, we take from the animals, we take from other people. And, of course, by doing it that way, we are creating future bondage as well. According to how we act and deal with others, we're going to get that result given to ourselves. So if we exploit people, we're going to be exploited. We go to the shop and we see a beautiful sweater, and look, it's only 20 pounds. You use pounds here, right?
Euros.
Oh, you use euros here. I thought you were using pounds here.
This isn't UK, my friend. Be careful.
I know. Well, that's why I asked.
Be careful here.
But last time, when I was in Belfast?
Belfast is the UK.
Northern Ireland.
Okay.
The province.
Okay.
This is the Republic.
Okay. Thank you.
We're all very identified.
Political lesson.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay. Okay, euros. It costs 20 euros. What a deal. Look at that. It's so beautiful. Only 20 euros. What's behind that? How did you get that beautiful piece of clothing for such a small price?
Some poor kid.
Yeah, because there's some girl in Bangladesh who's working 16 hours a day with no bathroom breaks and earning 5 rupees an hour. There's many sad stories like that. So we participate in a system. We're participating in a system unknowingly that's exploiting people. The system is arranged to that some people, they exploit the person who's producing the garment, and they produce, exploit the person who's buying it. Right? They're making a lot of money, perhaps, on that article. Much, much more than if it was, say, sold at just turnkey, what they call turnkey, just marked it up 100%. They can produce something, oh yeah, for I got a new, I got the next best thing, almost next best thing, our greatest thing. I got a Samsung Galaxy 2 recently. I joined the 21st century. Anyway, so they're selling little, you know, a little piece of plastic to put on the face of it to protect it. Right? Three little pieces of plastic for $15. $15. Why? Because perceived value. You know, you're going to protect your new toy. Anyway, they're making a lot of money on these things. So it's not a matter of, you know, just we sell it for what it costs with a reasonable markup, but we want to exploit. We want to exploit the producer. We want to exploit the earth. We want to exploit the consumer. We want to exploit everybody. So where is this going to take us? Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita, the result of tamagun, or the mode of ignorance, is
destruction of the world.
Destruction. So when people ask, well, what's the economic future? You know, is there going to be an economic collapse? It's very easy to answer that. You don't need a crystal ball. But if we understand how the world is working and understand that the system is going further and further and further into the influence of tamagun, we know that it must collapse at some point. So it's just a matter of when. So, karma. We can live a very nice life without exploiting the earth, without exploiting each other. But we have to learn how the world works. This is explained in Isopanishad. Ishvashamidam sarvam yat kinchan jagatcham jagat tena chiktena bhujita ma grita kashasvedanam. Everything animate and inanimate in this world is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things which are necessary as his quota, or which have been set aside as his quota, and not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. And the next shloka explains that one can go on living continuously. One can go on living this way for hundreds of years because this sort of work will not bind one to the law of karma. So this world's been created in a particular way to function perfectly. The invocation of Isopanishad, Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnam Udachite Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnam Evavashishite. This world is perfectly equipped as a complete whole. Everything that's necessary for the perfect functioning of this world has already been established. So it's perfect. There's no scarcity. There's no such thing as scarcity. Everything that everybody needs is already here. So if we understand how the world is working and understand the system by which it's set up, everyone on this planet can live harmoniously and happily with everything that they need for their comfortable life, and at the same time be satisfied. So the question that I bring to the economists then is, what's the purpose of our economics? We see they talk about GDP, you know, and profits and things like this, as if these things were the purpose of economics. And for modern economists, it is. But should it be? Why should it be? Why should it be that we simply focus on the gross national product? Well, you know, the king of Bhutan, he decided to do it a little differently. Maybe you've heard. They came up with what they called the gross happiness product, the GHP. And their idea was to see, who's happy? Are we happier this year than we were last year? Forget about the money. Well, are we happier? So in their country, they're orienting their activity to the GHP, not the GNP. Because they realize, you know, all this stuff is simply, you know, for what? To make us happy? Well, there's got to be more to it than that, because if stuff made us happy, then the already really, really rich people, they'd already be happy, right? And they'd stop exploiting everybody else. But it's not happening. Not only do they have it all, they have so much, right? Do you have the Occupy crowd over here? Do you have those protests?
Yeah.
You know, they're protesting the 1%. Well, it's not just the 1%, it's the top 15%. But because without the other 14%, the top 1% couldn't make it work. Anyway, if you take children's blocks, for example, you know, little, 2-inch by 2-inch or 10-centimeter by 10-centimeter blocks, and each one representing $1,000. And you stack them up for most, if they represent income, right, for people. If you stack them up, most people's stack of blocks would be within 1 meter of the ground. And the 1%, their stack of blocks goes higher than the Eiffel Tower. Right? So they already have so much. Why do they need more? Well, this is also explained in spiritual economics. That no amount of material things is sufficient to satisfy the soul. Because we're spiritual beings, this material world, these material things, they don't satisfy us. They simply leave us empty and unsatisfied. So there's a great need at this time for this idea of spiritual economics to help people understand how not to destroy the world. We hear the protesters are saying, or the environmentalists, they're saying that we can't go on this way because modern economics is dependent on ever-increasing production of goods. But we have a finite planet, so sooner or later there's going to be a crunch. Or let's put it this way, if everybody in the planet was to live at the same standard of Western Europeans or Americans, we'd need 3 more planets. Of course, we only have one. So they're saying that we have to reevaluate the situation, go back to the drawing board and look at what the heck we're doing. The challenge is they don't have the tools to do that successfully. You know, we have a box of ideas with which we understand the world and how we live our lives. And we get that box of ideas by learning from, generally from our indoctrination in schools and universities. And there's so many ideas that are out there that are floating around. And generally the ideas that are taught in our schools are the ones that will keep us in a limited mindset of thought, a limited way of understanding, so that the 1% can continue to exploit the 99%. In that set of ideas, we can't find the solution to today's problems. They're not there. Because in that set of ideas, whatever solution we find there simply creates more problems. Right? Any kind of thing, you know. Okay, we create a car to solve the transportation problem. Now we've got a road problem. We've got an oil problem. We've got a, you know, pollution problem.
Accidents,
health. You know, so many more problems. So yeah, we solved one problem and created 10 more. So modern society is like that. But the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedic literature, they give us an expanded set of ideas with which we can understand the world and actually solve the problems without creating more. We get concepts like the jiva, the purusha, karma, samsara. So these different ideas are helping us understand our spiritual nature, how the spiritual being lives in this material world, how it's influenced by it, and how to be happy. That's the main thing. Because we find that if we can actually become happy and satisfied, I've got enough. So we see pictures of sages where they're living in the forest with what? They've got a loincloth and a water pot. And they're happy. They don't want more. They don't need more. They don't want more. Or if you go to Kumbh Mela. You ever go?
No, I haven't been.
Kumbh Mela is one of the largest spiritual gatherings in the world.
2 million.
2-3 million people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they come to the confluence of the Ganges, Jamuna, and
Saraswati.
Once every 4 years, and then there's a Mahamela every 12 years. And so there you see all the naked Babas and all the yogis. They come out of the Himalayas to take bath at the confluence of these rivers, because by bathing there at that auspicious time, one is guaranteed to be out of this world, liberation. So all these, you see them, some hundreds of years old. They're not interested in anything. They come out of the hills for this event, then they go back. They know how to be satisfied. With what? With nothing. Because satisfaction comes from within. So this is the information, the knowledge, the set of ideas that we need to solve the problems of the world today. Otherwise, all the attempts that everybody's making, they're not sufficient. The environmentalists, for example, one fellow, he was saying like, well, we're trying to save one forest at a time. But he realized it's not enough, because they're cutting them down so fast, it's just, you can't keep up with it. So, what's the solution? You can't save it just one at a time. There has to be a systemic, a holistic change in the way we're thinking, the way we're living, the way we our approach to life. And there's a lot of people who are thinking like this. They see we can't go on like this. But one of these professors, very intelligent fellow, he says we need a new way of thinking about the world. We need a new way of understanding. He said, but I don't know how to create that. How do you create a new way of living? They don't know how to do it. That answer is given in the Vedas. It's given in Bhagavad Gita. Because understanding who we are as spiritual beings, how we're living in this world, how to find happiness and satisfaction, this is the key that's needed for solving not only the economic problem, but it'll solve the social problem, the political problem, all the problems, if we take it up. So that's the challenge. How many are going to take it up? Individually, we can take it up, and we can solve our individual problems. And, okay, I'm fine. I got mine, right? A lot of people, they think like that. I got mine. You're on your own. Good luck. But actually, spiritually advanced person, he's not thinking, I got mine. You're on your own. He's thinking. His only suffering is to see the suffering of others. And he's very eager to see how to help them become happy. So this is Prabhupada's desire, why he began Hare Krishna movement, to give this knowledge that we can use, that we can apply it in our lives and solve our own personal problem, and then solve our collective problems also. Is that the right time? Ten after nine?
Yeah.
Okay. So how late, maybe we should stop and discuss.
It's up to you, Prabhu.
I don't know how late you go. Midnight?
We go until 10. You're free to continue.
Okay, if we're going to stop at 10, let's stop and discuss.
I don't know. Are you
cold?
You're cold?
No, it's okay.
So let's discuss. I can ramble on and on.
Very nice. Very nice presentation. Great rambling.
Yeah. I like the way you speak. Is it the first person where we go, we are this, rather than going, they are like this, you know, because then it's like more humble that we're admitting that we're all the same and we all are affected by this Timaya nature.
Mm-hmm. We're all in the boat together.
Mm-hmm. In it together.
Yeah.
And the example of the sages at the Kumbh Mela being satisfied with the loincloth and a water pot. If we think of the spiritual world, how everything there is very
beautiful, people are beautiful, they're dressed beautifully.
I think Prabhupada mentions how the gopis, they would like to ornate themselves and dress nicely for Krishna.
So it would seem to me that unless one has a conception of an eternal life where one's aesthetic needs and, you know, the need for perfection and completion in every aspect, then it would be very difficult for a person to be satisfied with the bare minimum in this life, because they would be hankering for that completion and perfection through material things, because they don't have an alternative concept.
There's a underlying principle that's operating. Lord Brahma is the creator of the universe. Do you know this story? The Vedic creation story, Lord Brahma?
Yeah.
Where is he? He's right here. Being born out of the navel of Vishnu. So Vishnu is the primary creator. Brahma is the secondary creator. So Vishnu gave us the basic elements, and then Brahma, he fashions them into everything that we see. So before he did his creation, Brahma, he first had to create the conditions necessary for the universe to be a success. So first thing we have to understand is, why is this all created? Why is this here? Many people ask this question. Why is there anything? Well, we won't go into that one, but we'll start with the fact that there's jivas, like unlimited numbers of jivas, and they have desires.
Just tell them a jiva.
Oh, okay. Jiva are unlimited numbers of living beings, like us. Not like us, us. Us and all the others, like us.
Souls.
So there's one big soul, God, and all the innumerable little souls. We have desires. We, from our previous lives, wanted to enjoy the material energy in various ways. And so therefore, this forces the creation. For us, it's for us. It's not for God. God doesn't create it for himself or to be mean and just stick us here. No, we wanted to be here. We have desires. So in order for us to come here and be happy, or let's say to try to find some satisfaction in our desires, Brahma had to create the preliminary circumstances. So one of those is a material conception of life, that I have the conception that I am the body. And then another one of those initial conditions is that I have a false sense of proprietorship, that I can acquire things. This is mine. Actually, what can we own? If we just analyze it for 2 minutes, we can understand we come into this world with nothing. When we leave, we take nothing with us. So our claim for proprietorship is empty. But we have that illusion. My house, my car, my bank account, my this, my that, my body. It's not, none of it is ours. It's being given to us so that we can try to fulfill those desires. So we start out, we can say in one sense, with this disadvantage that I think, what were the other conditions? Another one was important. You remember? Do you remember that?
Conditions for?
Preliminary conditions for creation. Wow. Brahma's condition in the third canto.
Ignorance of self. Ignorance of.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Do you remember more precisely? That's not it.
You want me to get in the book?
Forgetfulness. Do you have it? Yeah. I think it's third canto.
I get it for you.
I don't remember exactly where it is.
Well, you're going to have to find it.
So we'd have to be under Maya in order to.
Yeah. The illusory bodily conception of life. Thank you. That's it.
But that's
it. Well, we have to be an illusion.
Catherine got it.
The illusory conception of life. Okay. So I have to have this idea, I'm this body, okay? I was saying bodily conception of life, but you said Maya, huh? This is it. It's illusory conception of life. I think I'm the body. I think I'm the enjoyer, huh? And how am I going to enjoy? I'm going to enjoy by sense gratification. So everyone in this material world labors under those conditions. To one extent or another, either greater or lesser extent, depending upon our level of spiritual understanding. And so, most people, without having any spiritual knowledge, spiritual training, we have no other way of approaching life than to think, well, yeah, I got that thing and it really made me happy, and I'll get another thing, I'll go shopping again, and I'll just keep on going shopping and I'll always be happy, right? But it doesn't work. So many people, you know, they become frustrated and unhappy, and then after a while cynical, because it doesn't work. And then they wonder, well, I guess we just can't be happy, you know? No. Happiness, the reason we want to be happy is because it's already present in our own spiritual nature. The happiness that we're looking for already exists, but we've being distracted and preoccupied with what's going on externally, we don't look within. So the happiness, that satisfaction that we desire, cannot be found outside. We have to understand how to find it by connecting with our own spiritual nature, by connecting with God. And so that's the secret. Now, is that okay? An answer to your point?
Well, I'm just making the point that because the spiritual world is perfect and complete, and all of our desires, for example, people have.
Okay, you're contrasting the material world and spiritual world. So,
well, I'm making the point that, say, people have a desire to look beautiful, to be beautiful, to live in a beautiful place, to have a beautiful relationship with someone. And that's coming from the soul, because the soul originally enjoyed that. So the point that I'm making is that unless one was had a concept of the spiritual world in which all of these needs are fulfilled, then they wouldn't opt for the sort of loincloth and water pot, because the need has to be fulfilled somewhere.
Does it work like that? The fundamental problem is that we are trying to be God. Not God in the sense of God the Creator, but Bhagavad Gita explains the position of the Lord. Bhaktaram jagatapasam saralokaha maheshwaram sridam sarvabhutanam gyantvamam shantamichati. The position of the Lord is He is the enjoyer, and He is the only enjoyer. He's the proprietor, and He's the only proprietor. And He is the dearmost friend of all living beings. When we try to take the position of the Lord in any of these ways, we put ourselves under the control of illusion, because we can't be God. That's not our position. To say, no, this sounds a little confusing, that if God is the only enjoyer, well, what about me? I mean, certainly we've all experienced some enjoyment. We have some idea, what is that, you know, to enjoy. So how is it God is the only enjoyer? The answer to this is that we have a specific relationship to the Lord. And when we are properly situated in that relationship, we will be happy, satisfied, and filled with enjoyment. But our enjoyment must be in relationship to the Lord. The problem in this world is that we try to find that happiness without any connection with the Lord. And therefore, when that happens, this means I want to be the proprietor. Well, you can't be the proprietor. I can't be the proprietor. So therefore, Maya, she covers this up to where I think, yes, I'm the proprietor. This is my house, my car, my this, my that. Although I'm not, because of my desire, I get put into illusion. So that illusion is not removed by saying, okay, well, I'll be happy in Vaikuntha, in the spiritual world. No. Because to go to that spiritual world, one must give up that consciousness that I am the center and everything else is the object of my enjoyment. This is our position in the material world. I am the center and everything is here for me to enjoy. Now, since I'm the enjoyer, I decide what is good, what is bad, what I like, what I don't like, right? I like this art, I don't like that art, right? The art you didn't like, it's not on your walls. The art you did like, it's there. I like this man, I don't like that man. I like this woman, I don't like that woman. I like this country, I don't like that country. Yeah, so many things, whatever it is, huh? So what we're doing, we take the position of being the arbiter, the decider. What is good, what is bad? I like this, I don't like that. When we do that, we create duality. I'm taking the position of God, and from the position of God, I'm deciding what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, and I create the duality. The problem is, I can't just get one half of the duality.
That's right? So frustrating.
Yeah.
You're doing things all day, every day, and there's the black and white being thrown at you.
Yeah.
Totally.
Every 2 seconds.
I want the good stuff, I don't want the bad stuff, right? So we have a saying like that in America, I'm going to get it together. Right? You know that saying? I'm going to get it all together and I'll just have all the happy stuff and the not happy stuff, the bad stuff. I won't be affected by that, right? It's not possible. It's impossible. Because I'm creating the duality. as long as I create the duality, you can't have one side of a coin, right? A coin has two sides. Back end of the car goes where the front end of the car goes. That's the way the world works. So we're trying like this, trying to run away from all that bad stuff, leave that all behind, and I'm just going to have a happy life with none of the bad stuff. Impossible. Huh? Why? Because I'm trying to take the position of the enjoyer. If I want to find happiness, real happiness and satisfaction, I have to become free from duality. I can't just have half a duality. If I'm going to be in duality, I have to have both halves. You have to. So the only way to change that is to become free from duality. And that is to put God in the position of the enjoyer. And I put myself at his feet as his servant. He is the enjoyer of everything, including me. I am meant for his enjoyment. Then, in that capacity, I see everything not in relationship to me. I see everything in relationship to God. The duality goes away. No duality. In this situation, I'm qualified then to enter the spiritual world.
Okay, I agree with what you said completely. But I want to address Maheshwar's statement from a different perspective.
Okay, sure.
Vishnu or God is Bhagavan. So Aishwaryasya Samagrasya Viryasya Yashasashriya Jnana Vairagya Yashchapi Shanam Bhag Itingana. So Vishnu has, God by definition has six opulences. Wealth, Aishwarya, Virya, power, talent, ability, strength, Virya, Yashas, fame, Shri, beauty, Jnana, knowledge, and Vairagya, renunciation. God has these by definition in full. That's God. We, being parts and parcels of God, reflections of the Godhead, have some of these qualities to a lesser extent, reflecting the Godhead. So, to go back to the loincloth yogis and sages, in the Himalayas that show up during Kumbh Mela, etc., they carry the greatest manifestation of Vairagya. This is how they reflect the Godhead, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on how God conscious they are, but as you said, their joy is in having the minimum. That is their joy. Would that be your joy? Not necessarily. Because you may not reflect the bhagas, the divine qualities, in the same way. So your joy may be in carrying the wealth. Your joy may be in carrying the beauty. Because we all reflect God in different ways. And in the spiritual world, everything's available. And nothing's, and again, as you say, naturally, God has to be at the center. So we can't, if we place ourselves at the center, it all goes awry. It's just a question of time. I think from that perspective, different people will express these different aspects of the Godhead. So that's how I would answer that.
Thank you for pointing that out. I hope you didn't think that you're all going to wind up in the Himalayas with a wine cloth. Important clarification.
I told them that or the sages or anyone in any situation, the quality is of Atmaram, someone who's self-satisfied. And that's the quality that as conditioned souls we lack.
Yeah. you know, like George Harrison. When George Harrison came to Prabhupada, George Harrison from the Beatles, he said, well, should I shave my head and become a monk and live in one of your temples? He said, no. He said, you are in a very good situation. You are who you are. You do what you do. Many people listen to you. You just go on. Just chant. Chant Hare Krishna. And try to follow the regulative principles as best you can and carry on with your life. So he had a specific virya, talent or ability, and he had yashas, he had fame, and he had wealth because of that. And so he wrote songs about Krishna. And that's how he served, using his divine opulence or reflection of the divine opulence. In fact, you probably know this, but the song Something, Something in the Way She Moves, that one? Mm-hmm. Actually, he wrote that for Krishna. But he couldn't say Something in the Way He Moves because it wouldn't sound heterosexual. It sounded different. So he said, he changed it, the he to she. That's yeah. I don't want to leave him now. You know I believe, and how.
She
sang
something as well.
Yeah, well, she would have sung it from a women's point of view. Yeah. Anyway, this is a small anecdote. That would be another example of it.
Very nice.
So it is about putting God first.
Yeah, it was so funny when you're talking about the whole I was just in my mind of thinking about all the Sadhu Babas in Himalayas and everything, and you just talk about that. And then I look at the sage and I say, wow. Some flavor. Just thinking about it. Because they are so like I've been to Badrinath and Hemkutsa, you know, they're really up top, but then some of the yogis seem that they just sit in there, they're so satisfied, they are just so, you know, they're so happy.
Walking to Badrinath in the first place, I find amazing.
We drove to Badrinath with a taxi driver and an ambassador, which was what, a 14-hour drive? About a 14-hour drive. All the way up, 10,000 feet. There's more, 12,000. Mm-hmm. And all the sadhus are walking alongside the road. They're walking to Badrinath. Most have no shoes. Some have shoes. And all their worldly possessions are on their back, which is usually a blanket, maybe a change of clothing, water pot, danda, stick. And there's how many of them? Countless.
Many, many, many.
They have their own world.
Well, they're not hitchhiking. They're not waving down the next vehicle.
Yeah, and we're given eight that it's going to take us 14 hours to get there, and it's taken them months.
Back to the ambassador.
Puts it into perspective.
There's an interesting alternative to the loincloth and water pot example in Chaitanya Charitamrita and Jain. Pundarik Vijayanidhi. Is that Gadadhar's Gadadhar Pandit spiritual master? Pundarik. So he was like externally he looked like a complete materialist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was extolling the glories of this devotee, and Gadadhar Pandit was a little surprised. I think Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told him to take initiation from him, is that right?
So didn't he go with Jiva or somebody?
Yeah, he went to the house and like
you know, the Pundarikvijanidhi was having his oil hair. The servant's putting oil in the chair, and he was reclining on a luxurious couch, and the whole thing just looked completely material.
Well, I think it was a tent, a temporary tent he had set up or something, wasn't it? But it was very opulent.
Yeah, very opulent.
And the best
palatial.
Palatial, yeah.
Palatial, yeah.
And Gadadhar Pandit was completely bewildered how, you know, this person is recommended as a sadhu. But then Mukunda was it, I think, recited a verse, from the Bhagavatam, and then Pundarikvijanidhi went into this complete ecstasy. Started smashing things and everything, just in an ecstasy of Lord Krishna. And then later Gadadhar Pandit realized he had made a mistake by assuming that this person was not a great devotee just because of his opulent appearance or his external material position. It's a very nice lesson.
Yeah, very, very nice. Very powerful.
Bhakti is independent and external.
Yeah, you can't judge by
externals.
Last Sunday, Sunday before, I was in Bhakti with Vedanta and Watford.
Vedanta Manor?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a Radha Ashtami.
Oh, you were there for Radha Ashtami?
Yeah.
Nice.
Lots of nice food there.
Yeah. Not good.
They end up like, you know, they're just like serving the food later.
Yeah, that's nice. I love serving prasad. I don't like much other kind of serving. That
I love.
You like hanging out to Mahabho.
Mahabho.
Yeah. Well, whatever. It's fine. It's simple to me.
Prabhu, under that blue binder is a page. Could you pass that to me? No, actually.
Not the binder?
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, this page.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks. Do you want to say, can I talk about this a little
Please, bit? I was reading it earlier a little bit and I didn't finish. So I want to hear it.
This is really, really something else. Uttama Sloka sent it to me.
Where is it from?
Yeah, this is by Bhaktivinod Thakur, who was an acharya or a great teacher in the same line. Of devotional service of Bhakti Yoga. And it's from the Chaitanya Shikshamrita, Chapter 7, Part 2. So this is actually pretty elevated stuff, but it's so beautifully said. I've never heard it said like this before, so I thought I would maybe share this with you this evening. There are two types of worshippers, those which with knowledge of rasa and those without knowledge of rasa. What is rasa? Do you remember?
Relationship.
It's relationship. It is taste. It is mellow. It is connection to God. It's the feeling you get when you worship God. That's your rasa. It's a specific kind of relationship that you have with God. We've talked about a neutral, when people worship God in awe and reverence, or when you become the friend of God, or you become the parent of God. These are different rasas. We've also talked about that from time to time. So, rasa is one of those words like dharma that has many, many meanings. But essentially, it's spiritual taste. Those without knowledge of rasa also experience a slight degree of rasa. Being ignorant of the truth, they call it meditation, concentration, absorption, trance, prayer, or worship. So those who do not have the full taste of rasa, but get a little zap now and then, that's what they call it. Meditation, contemplation, absorption. That's most of us, by the way. When people become absorbed in prayer or worship, an experience rises from their inner soul, shakes the mind, and affects the outer body like lightning.
like this. They realize that if they could remain in that state constantly, there would be no more suffering. Isn't it? Because once you get that taste, the spiritual taste, you keep hankering for it again and again and again. That's what keeps us around. Keeps us interested. Right? What is that state? Is it material, mental, or something opposite of material? Searching the whole universe, nothing can be found to compare to this experience. It cannot be counted among the subtle side effects of material energy, such as electricity or magnetism, because it's more than that. Examining the mind, it cannot be found there either. In the negation of material thought as well, there is nothing comparable. From where has this experience come? Examining carefully, it may be found that it is coming from the pure existence of the soul. That's where it comes from. Which is presently covered by matter. When engaged in the act of worship, they experience this state, but it is not analyzed in detail, so let us examine it more closely. This indescribable state is a particular quality or function. The function must have a subject or ashraya. So the subject is the ashraya. The pure soul, which is covered by the material body, material mind, is the shelter of that function. You with me? That's us. On realizing that the soul is small and dependent on a higher power, this function suddenly reveals itself like the flame that appears upon striking a match. The thing to which the function moves is its only object, the vishaya. The subject, the object. The ashraya, the vishaya. The soul and God. God. By proximity to the object through the process of worship, the function can emerge from ashraya, the soul, and flow toward the object, vishaya. This function is the sthayi bhava. Now it gets a little complex. The bhavas are the different levels of
mood,
taste, love, you know, like infatuation would be a bhava. You know, between a man and a woman. Deep love would be a deeper bhava. Loyal love would be a deeper bhava, for example. Okay? But we're talking about soul with God. Okay. This function is a sthayi bhava. Sthayi means fixed. It remains. The practitioner is the ashraya, and God is the vishaya. The qualities of God are the stimuli, is udipan. Udipan comes from the word deep, to shine, to glow. So God has all these little shiny, glowy qualities. When the function is combined with the subject and the object, the function meaning what goes on between them, immediately, anubhavas or external symptoms appear in the subject. You start to show symptoms. One or more of the 13 anubhavas will certainly appear in the person. Some of the 31 vyabhachari bhavas will also assist in the external manifestation of the experience. Some persons will also experience some of the sattvika bhavas. So that's where it gets a little complex. So, what are some of the bhavas? Heart palpitations. Hair standing on end, perspiration, sighing, becoming flushed. You know, when you're experiencing a higher spiritual taste, these can be some of the bhavas, for example. Okay. Now consider, what is worship? After analyzing all the parts of worship, it may be understood that worship is nothing but rasa. Worship is attainment of a state of experience stemming from a basic state of consciousness assisted by vibhava, anubhavas, sattvika bhavas, and vyavichari bhavas. Thus, worship is rasa. So when you're worshiping God or praying to God, you're involved in the rasa, in the relationship. Now, this is the part we're getting to. Material action, material thought, and nirvishesha, anti-material thought, are not worship. So anything you do materially is not an example of worship, because God is not involved. And what does this mean? Nirvishesha, anti-material thought. Nirvishesha means Mayavada philosophy, oneness. I am God, you are God, we're all God. There can be no worship if you're God. Who do you worship? There's no one to worship. There's no ashraya and vishaya, there's no subject object, because you already believe you're God. So without an object for your affection, there's no rasa. Correct? You can't say you're in love with somebody if there is nobody to be in love with. And if you're in love with yourself, there's no relationship. Then you'd be a narcissist. So, same idea here, sort of. These are all without rasa. All groups of worshippers depend on the actions of rasa, but being ignorant of the process of rasa, they cannot be made to understand rasa in a scientific way. This is due to the influence of previous bad association or previous conditioning. So if you hang around people who are solely materialistic, then you're going to become more and more materialistic. If you hang around people who think that we're all God, I'm God, you're God, we're all God, and that too will prevent you from a higher taste, from developing rasa. Okay, final paragraph. Worship as rasa is of three forms: restricted, slightly revealed, and fully revealed. Some people experiencing rasa in a restricted way cannot feel it after leaving the activity of worship. So while you're worshiping, while you're chanting, while you're praying, while you're meditating, and you make the connection and you're feeling that spiritual high or spiritual rasa, and as soon as you stop doing that, it's gone. So that's what he means by that one, right? That's a restricted way. The reason is that they are now enjoying material rasa. So they've enjoyed spiritual rasa, now we're going back to material rasa. Okay, I'm going to make a sandwich. Yep, whatever. As no one can live without rasa, no one can live without rasa. What a statement. This is from Bhakti Vinod. Who can live without rasa? Nobody. Unless you're an automaton, unless you're a robot, you can't live without rasa. That's why when Mayavadis achieve the first level of God realization, which is merging into... Brahman realization. After a while, what happens? They come back down. Why? Because they get bored.
No rasa.
There's no rasa. It makes complete sense. But I've never heard it explained like this before. So the reason is that no one can live without rasa. The lives of these people are full of material rasa. So you either need material rasa or spiritual rasa. The problem with material rasa is the law of satiation. And that's what Dineshwar Prabhu has pointed out this evening in various ways you can't go on like that because it doesn't satisfy. Spiritual rasa is placing God in the center, and that's what will expand over time. It doesn't. It is not subject to the law of satiation. Spiritual rasa is a temporary thing, like a flash of lightning in the lives of such people. So you get that spiritual bhava, flash of lightning, and you go, oh, I could just get that all the time.
I think that's just as much as one of those, you know, like a fish that they have too, of ecstasy.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's to enter into that rasa and sustain it. Wasn't that good?
Yeah.
Oh,
I'd like to get a copy.
Another copy of it.
Yeah,
I mean, this is.
That's from Chaitanya
Shikshamrita. Yeah. Oh. Some more paragraphs. Anticlimactic. By association of other devotees and the guru, this condition becomes elevated and gradually begins to open slightly. But by lack of good association, by teachings from atheists or impersonalists, this worship becomes gradually more restricted, extremely restricted, and then almost lost. This is very unfortunate for the soul. In the slightly open state, worship penetrates into the life of the person. The person gravitates toward places where they can hear topics of rasa. Look at all of you. You gravitated here to hear topics of rasa provided by Dhaneshwara Prabhu. Such a person is indifferent to atheists and impersonalists. In the fully open state, rasa is fully realized. Being realized, it acts continuously. In the open state, rasa is revealed in the form of Shanta, Dasya, Vatsalya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. Those are the five rasas. Neutral, becoming neutral to God, but in awe and reverence. Dasya, wanting to serve God. Sakya, becoming God's friend. Vatsalya, becoming God's parent. And Madhurya, becoming God's lover, wife.
Lover.
Or girlfriend.
Or girlfriend.
Lover, not wife.
But those qualified for Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya rasa are very few. Only by great fortune can the soul develop a taste. Bhaktivinoda. What an intellect. Now, I was explaining to Glenn today, so there's those who say that bhakti is just bhakti, the yoga of love and devotion, is just a bunch of sentiment. But it's actually one of the most complex analysis of philosophical systems that one can find, because it goes into such great detail. Especially as presented by the six Goswamis. Mm. That's them there. The guys dressed in loincloths. Not really interested. So they were on the renunciation page there when Vishnu handed out the bhagas.
I found it. So, the preliminary conditions of the creation. Brahma first created from the nascent activities. Nascent means covered by ignorance. Nascent engagements like self-deception, the sense of death, anger after frustration, the sense of false ownership, and the illusory bodily conception, or forgetfulness of one's real spiritual identity.
What's the verse number?
3:12:2. So this self-deception, meaning that I'm the enjoyer, the sense of false ownership, this is mine, I'm the enjoyer, I am the proprietor, and illusory bodily conception of life, I'm the dearmost friend of others. So those conditions had to be there for people to think that they are enjoying the material world. Without those, if we knew, or sometimes people, they say, why can't we remember a previous life? You know, we hear people, they go for past life regression. And, you know, why can't we remember that naturally? Because it would spoil our fun, you know. If I knew I was whatever my last life, you know,
Queen Victoria,
I'm the queen, and now I'm just a nobody. Huh?
That's it. Everybody's Queen Victoria.
Cleopatra.
Cleopatra. That's it. One of those two. No, so much. And now I'm just
little old me. So.
Okay, why don't we just I'll do a little bit of a closing chant.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Yeah. So I brought a few books.
Yeah. Dineshwar has some books of his spiritual economics. So we can, those are available.